Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, based on the performance of Nico, the YouTube prankster who has come, I think, fifth in the London mayoral elections, are you going to rethink your you know, choice not to stand for office in future?
Probably not, no. that's a very simple response from me. But he did do really well. I just assume it's all of the kids down Westfield, isn't it?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, who knew you could transfer that sort of YouTube fame into, you know, potentially contending for office with a respectable 2% of the vote?
I think the world is probably grateful that I never saw mild YouTube success as something that I could transfer into the political sphere, other than having a podcast. So.
Very much so. We meet usually every 2 weeks, but we sometimes every week to discuss politics, current affairs and social issues. And we are this time joined by Daniel Jacobs, a candidate for the Lundependents Party. Daniel, I was wondering if you could start by answering just something that has been making me curious as I've been researching you. Is your party really in favour of breaking London away from the UK and becoming an independent state?
Well, ultimately, yes. I mean, the UK may not exist for that much longer after all, if Scotland breaks away. So then it's a question of what London does. But yeah, I mean, it's not our immediate aim. Our immediate aim is to get more autonomy, more devolution, more power for London over its own affairs. But ultimately, yes, as the UK breaks up, then London needs to think about its own future. And being shackled to the corpse of England is not necessarily a good future for us.
So, Jazza, you had a question about sort of how this relates to kind of EU membership, because, yeah, do you want to...
Yeah, you'll be surprised to hear, both listeners and Daniel, I also did some research today. and so there seems to be, when you look at kind of like trends about London independence, both in terms of search traffic and also when it's been polled, when it's piqued the most interest, it first had like a bit of a spike after the 2014 Scottish independence referendum, of course, where the Scottish people voted to stay as part of the UK. And then immediately after the EU referendum, which is certainly when I first kind of heard people talking about London independence, I think because Scotland was kind of, or certain Scottish politicians were touting becoming independent as a route back into the United Kingdom, into the European Union. And Londoners were like, oh crap, we can't do that. And so there was more interest and more kind of like of a hubbub around the possibility of London independence. How much is, and obviously you are representative of a party and not everybody who wants London to be independent. But how much is your story about kind of pursuing London independence? How much of that is based in either of those two phenomena, Scottish independence and Scotland voting differently to the rest of the rest of England when it came to membership of the European Union?
Well, I mean, what started our party, what gave us the impetus was the EU referendum, the fact that London voted to stay and England voted to leave. Yeah, so that, and that produced, as you know, the petition for London independence, which James O'Malley started kind of as a joke, which you got 180,000 signatures.
I think I may have signed that, actually.
Fair enough, I certainly did. But yeah, not everybody who supports our party wants outright independence. A lot of people just want more autonomy. And yes, we look at Scotland, we see what power Scotland has over its own affairs. Scotland with 5.5 million people, London with 9 million people, more than Scotland and Wales combined. Scotland has power over its education system, over its criminal justice system, over the environment, over all sorts of things. Well, London is left effectively, really, with just the powers of a local authority. And it's kind of ridiculous. London has nothing like the power over its own affairs that Berlin has, that Madrid has, that New York has. So, you know, there is, yes, on the one hand, as you say, the fact that Scotland has proper devolution, that Scotland is looking for its independence. That's one inspiration. And the other thing is, as you also say, the EU, the fact that London wanted to remain while England wanted to leave, not only because of where it leaves us in relation to the EU, but also because it shows how big and growing a divide there is between our values here in London and our attitudes here in London and those out in England as a whole.
I've read you talk about the London bashing that happened during the EU referendum before, and as a, I feel weird saying that I'm a, because I'm not a Londoner, I'm an Essex boy, and I happen to live in East London now, but I guess I am a Londoner. I've lived here for like nearly 10 years.
Everyone who's in London, everyone in London, regardless of where they might come from, regardless of whether they're here permanently or just temporarily, so you know.
Yeah, 100%. But at the end of the day, Daniel, I grew up in a field, which is mild, and that like affected my upbringing more than kind of like living in. I don't know. Let's not talk about my own identity here.
Don't get started.
I will go on forever. But the interesting thing about kind of like the London bashing you talked about is because I was certainly aware of it. And it feels like the quote-unquote right thing to do, and what something like the Labour Party, which now is having to find out what it is in the face of it becoming kind of like an English party, an English and Welsh party at least, because they don't have very much success north of the border. How they seem to be trying, and some would argue failing, to bridge those gaps between smaller towns and rural areas and metropolitan areas. And you seem to be rejecting that and going, you know what, we're already down this cultural shift between the metropolitan areas and less built up areas. Let's just go whole hog and just leave the buggers. Is that holistically actually, can you make the case for me for that? Because I find it difficult, because really, shouldn't we be trying to bring everybody together? And this seems to be divisive in a certain way.
If London gets more autonomy, it may be that we will then sit more comfortably in the United Kingdom. That may well be. It's not necessarily the case that, you know, I'm trying to be divisive and, create divisions between London and England that aren't already there. But those divisions are there, and we need to look at them and say, well, you know, how can we do what's best for London and indeed what's best for other parts of England? And I would say that recognising those divisions and having a policy for London that's based on that recognition is a far better idea than pretending that they're not there and trying to do down London on the basis that it's not English enough and needs to be bashed into submission.
I was just, I want to talk about the devolution stuff because I think it's, if you don't mind me saying, a slightly more practical or a more realistic proposal than the independence thing. But on the independence thing, how do you see this working? So say Scotland becomes independent after another referendum, hypothetically. Maybe London decides to hold its own referendum somehow, and we vote to leave the UK. In practical terms, how do you see that sort of panning out? Is there going to be a border around the M25, or how's it going to work?
Well, it's difficult to say. Independence is kind of our ultimate aim. It's not an immediate aim. We're not thinking London should be independent tomorrow. But yes, it is a problem that there would be a border around the M25, for example. We wouldn't want it to be a hard border. We've got people commuting in to London to work every day of the week. That's not necessarily a problem. You know, there's people that commute from France to Switzerland and vice versa to work. So it's not necessarily a problem, but it does mean that we can't have a border that's too hard. That's for sure, yes. There's also other potential problems. Suppose London were to join the EU, we would have a question of, For example, we would need a road and rail corridor down to Europe. We'd probably need one up to Scotland as well. We'd need access to the Port of London, which is no longer, you know, between London Bridge and Tower Bridge as it once was. It's out by Tilbury, and, you know, that's where most of London's goods come in. So we would obviously need agreements with England over that sort of thing. But at the moment, you know, the first step that we're looking at is proper devolution of the sort that Scotland has. And for that, you don't need a border and you don't need to worry about these things. But yes, ultimately, if London became independent and rejoined the EU, then these would be questions that we'd need to consider, definitely.
Is there an inevitability to independence in your view? Or are you being a bit clever here, Daniel? And are you trying to shift the Overton window by going for independence so that more devolution is more likely to happen, perhaps? Because I'll be honest, Daniel, that a rail and road corridor between mainland Europe and London and London and Scotland feels... I don't think we really see anything like that anywhere in the world. Like, those independent countries and enclave states don't tend to have... They tend to be at the behest of the countries that they are encased in. I think of, like... The only examples that we really have are places like San Marino and Lesotho and other places like that. Often, when we talk about London independence, Singapore is come up. It comes up as kind of like an example, which is fair enough as an independent city state. But Singapore is an island that is able to kind of like make those practical have those practical controls over its borders. How realistic is like an actual independent London surrounded by England?
Well, it would certainly have difficulties, but I think it's realistic enough. You know, London, don't forget, subsidises England by a huge amount. And I don't think that we should stop doing that. But we might want things in return for that subsidy.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like this is the steps towards independence that are like more devolution, maybe a London Parliament, for example, which we haven't got very much polling on that, but that's not got a huge amount of support for within London at the moment, at the very least, which I guess is why you start a party, right? But it sounds like you want to put those institutions in place first before, you would have to, before any kind of independence happens. Is that correct?
Yeah, what we want is ever-increasing autonomy, ever-increasing self-government. So we want to start and see how far we go. It depends, obviously, on what people in London want. But we want to create a movement for greater autonomy leading towards possibly full independence. Let's see. Let's see how far it goes. But yeah, definitely.
So if we're assuming that, let's put independence to one side as like a sort of a stretch goal, if you want to call it that, what's your like...
Oh, no, stretch goals. Who? Hello, Silicon Valley, how are you?
Well, I mean, from the YouTuber, you know, I'm not sure I should take that. But what's your ideal kind of self-government for London within the context of still remaining in the UK or England? What does that look like exactly?
It looks like having a federal system. It looks like having a system where Scotland is one unit, London is one unit, Wales is one unit, and England is either one or various units according to what it wants. So in a federal system, you have decentralisation of power to London the same way that you do to Scotland, and the same way that you do to Wales. And that should be true for everywhere in the UK. It shouldn't just be true for some bits of the UK and not others.
So... In sort of practical terms, I mean, Jez has already mentioned like a London Parliament, I should say. We obviously already have a mayor who has some powers over, say, transport and policing, and we have an assembly that provides some scrutiny of the mayor, basically. So what exactly do you want if we have, say, the London, like, I assume you want a parliament at bare minimum. Do you also want a cabinet sort of in the same way Westminster has for the whole country, or how does that work?
I would say so, yes. I mean, the same as Scotland has.
Okay, so you've got like a First Minister of London, and they have a cabinet, and there's also a parliament, and it has sort of powers over all this kind of basically everything bar foreign policy and a few things like that. Is that your ideal state of affairs?
Yes, exactly, exactly. Much as in the United States, much as in Germany, in fact.
Daniel, I don't know how much of this podcast you have listened to, if any, but this kind of federal chat is catnip to us. So my my ears have pricked up. I want to ask Daniel, because we have the results in from the assembly elections, and Lunda Pendants as a party voting on the orange sheet. People got you ended up with about 5,000 votes across the whole of London. Now I don't want to be rude, but that is less than that's less than the guy from London Real who drank his own pee. That's less than Binface. That's less than the Communist Party. Where and like, there's no need. I'm not trying to kind of like be Andrew Murray and rude here, but I think there is a real practical thing. If you aren't currently, at the very least, being elected and chosen by the London electorate, what do you see your role as a party being, kind of going forward? Until, I assume, hopefully, you do end up getting the numbers of votes. How do you see yourselves working without those seats in the Assembly?
We see ourselves as building support on that 5,700 odd votes, 5,746 it was, I think. We see ourselves building on that. This is the first election we fought.
That was exactly the correct number of votes. I'm very impressed. Well done.
This is a pop quiz.
This is the first election we fought. Most people still aren't aware of our existence. Yes, it was kind of bitter to see that we got less votes than the Communist Party, but at least everyone knows who the Communist Party is. Not many people as yet know who we are. And so that's something we need to change. We need to build awareness. We need to take this, if you like, this acorn and let it grow into an oak. And that's an awful cliche. Sorry, I shouldn't have said.
It's no worse than stretch goals, I wouldn't say. So,
but, you know, we have now a base on which to build. And that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to build awareness of our existence. And that's what we'll continue to do. We'll continue to build on this and see how much support we can get in the future.
Sorry, would you hope to contest, say, the London Borough Council elections in the future? I assume you're not just going to wait around until the next London mayoral election and London Assembly elections. Do you have plans to contest other seats?
We haven't decided that as yet, I have to say. I don't want to be drawn in. I don't know if we have the resources to contest every London borough. So we'd have to look at that as well. But we may do, we may not. We haven't really decided that, so I can't really answer your question, I'm afraid.
That is okay. Was it, I've previously kind of written about some of the punitive costs of entering some of these contests. I mean, particularly the London mayoral one, you have to put down a £10,000 deposit. Did you find the kind of...
I assume you guys weren't affected by that because you didn't have a candidate for mayor, right?
Well, we had to put down a £5,000 deposit for the assembly.
So is that something that you found like a problem when you would you, for instance, if the deposit had been much lower for London mayor, could you have seen yourself running a candidate for that?
Yes.
Okay. And in sort of general terms, what is it like being a sort of small party and actually campaigning in these elections? I know this is a particularly weird time to be campaigning because of COVID, but what was that experience like?
Was it lots of kind of like tea meetings in gardens and stuff like that rather than in campaign centres? I imagine it's got a nice, more intimate feel.
No, not really. To be honest, most of our campaigning was online. Mm. So most of our campaigning was on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. We didn't have teams going out doing canvassing. We gave out leaflets. We went around meeting people, yes, but not on doorsteps. We weren't knocking on doors. The amount of leaflets we were able to give out was small. We don't have the numbers as yet to run a full-fledged campaign, but we're hoping that in the future that will change.
I kind of wanted to sort of go, I said earlier that we go back to some of the nitty-gritty of devolution. I've already asked you about sort of the structure of the government, but I noticed going through your manifesto, you had some kind of specific policy areas that you wanted to take a look at. So obviously, one of the big pledges that Sadiq Khan made during the campaign trail was to start this cannabis commission to look at kind of legalizing it, or, you know, at least changing the legal structure around cannabis. From your point of view, how practical is it for cities to be coming up with their own drug legislation laws? Because you could easily have a situation where, say, London decides to legalize cannabis, but, you know, maybe somewhere like Manchester doesn't for whatever reason, and you'd get this kind of hodgepodge of different drug laws. Obviously, that is a feature of devolution, but do you think drugs legislation policy, why do you think it sits well for a potential London sort of area rather than a nationwide legislation regime, basically?
Well, so far as cannabis is concerned, Sadiq Khan said he'll look into it. Boris Johnson has ridiculed him on the basis London doesn't have power to do this. And Boris Johnson is also saying there's no way that the UK will legalise cannabis. Why? Here in London, people want legalisation of cannabis by a margin of something like 3-1. We've seen in this election, there's been a huge reaction against Sadiq Khan, largely on the basis of the crime rate. The crime rate is largely driven by the drugs market. You know, all this violent crime, knifings and stabbings and all this stuff is largely to do with the drugs market being illegal. So, you know, cannabis, it's not just a civil liberties question. The problem of having a law against cannabis is that it generates huge amounts of income for criminal gangs, and that is in itself a problem. You look at what Brian Paddick did in Lambeth when he effectively decriminalised cannabis there. His main aim was, in fact, to clamp down on Brixton's actual drug problem, the problem of crack dens and stuff that was going on when he did that, and which he successfully eradicated. And I think it's the same thing is true of London. If we legalise cannabis while other places maintain laws against it, okay, it would make it more difficult for those places to police cannabis because people could come to London and get it legally. That's true, but it would be massively to London's benefit to have a legal cannabis market. Apart from anything else, we could make huge amounts of revenue out of it, as places like Colorado and California are doing. So I think, you know, there is no reason, so far as I can see, why something shouldn't be legal in London and illegal somewhere else, particularly if what's holding London back from a modern attitude to drugs is antiquated attitudes, you know, from old dears out in the sticks who still think, you know, you smoke a spliff, it'll turn you into a heroin addict or whatever. And Boris Johnson, a man who refuses to talk about his own drug use, and we're not talking cannabis here, is now trying to hold us back from having a modern drug law in order to pander to, as I say, older people out of town who don't really have too much knowledge about the implications of the drug laws, and who aren't really affected by, you know, the enforcement of them on the street.
So is your, I'm kind of drawing inferences here, but it kind of seems like you want basically London to take more power because you politically disagree with people who are from other areas of the country. I mean, we were talking about drugs there and you mentioned old dears in the sticks, so that would be a particular stereotype. And, you know, there's a lot of areas in policy where you do see big regional differences, you know, between the urban and the rural or whatever. But some people would say that they actually see drug taking as a moral question, and that they would like it to be legislated on a nationwide basis, so that there's a sort of national moral consensus on that. So what would you say to them?
Well, I don't really see how it's a moral question, unless you think it's immoral to take drugs, which is...
Well, quite a lot of people would say that.
Okay, well, I think that's a strange attitude. I think we need to look at it as a health question. We need to think... You know, the problem with drugs is the harm that they cause. the people who become addicted to them, the crime rate or the criminal gangs that base their existence on them, and even in so far as cannabis is concerned, the fact that strong high THC forms of cannabis are, you know, more harmful than the traditional kinds of cannabis that we had previously. These kind of things can be regulated if it's legal. They can't be regulated if we go, no, taking drugs is immoral, therefore we're just going to ban it and imprison people who we catch doing it. And particularly if the people who we catch doing it are kind of not really a cross-section of people in society who are using drugs, but kind of basically young people and particularly young black people who are being stopped and searched for cannabis far more than the population as a whole.
Okay, is there, I mean, I know that you sort of want full independence, so this is in some ways a ridiculous question, but what areas of policy do you think could be legitimately held by, you know, the British government in Westminster, or say a future English government, assuming that, you know, Scotland and so on became independent?
Well, obviously foreign policy.
Okay.
And that's the obvious one.
Is that it?
It's okay if it is, but what would be your priorities in terms of the powers that you would want to reclaim from central government to a more devolved London government? Is it education? Is it drugs policy, for example? What are the priorities for you? What do you think are this is what we need as soon as possible?
Well, I think the most immediate things are the things that the UK government is trying to muscle in on in London, notably transport and housing. These are two areas where London is supposed to already be autonomous, and yet we have Sadiq Khan produces his housing plan. Robert Jenrick immediately wades in and starts trying to change it. That, number one, should be in London's power, not in Westminster's power. And number two, transport. Again, transport for London is in a terrible situation because of the way that its grant was withdrawn. Its operating grant was withdrawn in 2018. That's left it heavily dependent on fares. And the government has then taken advantage of this crisis to try and nationalise control over TfL. So I would say the first two priorities are to regain control for London over housing and over transport. And I would say the third one is policing. We've got London is the only place in the country which doesn't elect its police commissioner, supposedly because we elect the mayor instead. But in reality, the mayor has to divide his powers over the Metropolitan Police with the Home Office. And that's not right. London should have as much control over its own policing as any other part of the country. So I would say, so far as immediate priorities go, housing, transport and policing are the three where I would say it's the most important.
On the police commissioner side of things, my perception is that the kind of rollout of those offices as elected offices has not been terribly successful. And one of the major reasons for that is that barely anyone votes for them. So that the public just don't seem to be that interested in electing police commissioners. So why would we introduce one in London?
Well, there's been an awful lot of criticism of the police in London, and it's largely to do with the fact that they're controlled by the Home Office and not by London. You look at the way that the police, for example, in stop and search and also in enforcement of COVID regulations have been clearly discriminating against notably black people, also young people more generally. And these are things that would be harder if the police were responsible to Londoners rather than to the Home Office, for example. So, it's true that not everybody is interested in electing a police commissioner, but a police commissioner who was more responsible, more accountable to Londoners. The race is not the only issue as well. There's issues like domestic violence, crimes against women, which the police are also not really taking up to the extent that public opinion would like to see them take it up. So, you know, I think if the police were more accountable to people in London, there would be a much more sensitive form of policing than we currently have.
And you're not sort of deterred by the low vote, you know, the low turnout for these elections in other places then?
Yes, I am. But I think that, you know, in London, we need to have more accountability. And whether or not people take advantage of it or not is important. But at the end of the day, people have to decide whether they want to vote or abstain. And those who vote, yeah, should have the say over who is in charge of the police here.
Just to kind of like, we've kind of already asked you about what your next steps are and what your future is, which is a little bit up in the air. But what kind of like, what do you see as success for London Independence and also like the London Independence Party? What do you count as success in, say, 5 years' time? Basically, Daniel, this is a job interview. And I'm asking you, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Well, I hope that we see ourselves with a much higher level of support, with, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 voters rather than 5,000. Mm. So that's for a start. And I hope also that our existence is an impetus for people like Sadiq Khan, for example, to demand more power for London. So, yeah, we hope to have more supporters, and we hope that our influence will help anyone who wants greater devolution for London.
So that goal would put you around the same level as, like, the Rejoin EU Party, Reform UK, UKIP, etc. And that's kind of, like, what you'd be aiming for in the next 5 years, to be kind of just outside of the big four who gain seats in the Assembly.
Well, realistically, I can't expect us to win, you know, the mayoralty or the assembly in 3 or even 5 years from now.
Daniel, set your hopes high. Mayor Daniel Jacobs, 2026, let's go.
I'm not sure that I would actually like myself to be mayor, to be honest, but if no one else wants to do the job.
I mean, what strikes me is that most of the politicians who are running for, you know, the London Assembly or the London Mayor are probably going to be on your side when you say we want more powers for these offices, because they'd be the ones exercising them. Surely the people you really need to take the fight to are the government in Westminster, which would, you know, potentially mean running for MP seats. And it would mean convincing people kind of on a national basis that London, you know, more powers for London were a good thing. You can't really achieve what you want to achieve. Even if there was a Mayor Daniel Jacobs, he wouldn't be able to legislate for more power for London, right?
That's true. And yes, I would like to see us fight parliamentary elections. Again, it depends on having the resources to do it. It also has the problem that if you put up a candidate for a parliamentary election with our current voting system, you risk dividing the opposition vote and allowing government candidates to win. So that is a problem that we would need to be aware of. We wouldn't want, for example, to be fighting, I think, marginal seats. But yes, I would like to see us fighting parliamentary elections. It's a question of having the resources to do so. But yes, I would very much like to see us do that. Mm-hmm.
Oh, let's not open the can of worms that is electoral reform, because that, again, is catnip to me and Jimmy on the Right Dishonourable podcast. Shall we wrap up here? And Daniel, do you want to give us, like, where can they find out more? Where can they support you, etc.? What are your links? What are your deets?
Well, we've got a website, www.londependence.party. You can find out who we are there. We've also got a blog on it, which is even not particularly about politics. It's just about London. But so far as electoral reform goes, you don't want to open a can of worms?
Oh, no. Honestly, it's like 50% of our content is us complaining about the election system. And Daniel, we probably agree in some way, shape or form. We agree with most smaller parties.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. London Borough elections are in three-member wards. Mm-hmm. So you already have three-member wards. Having an STV voting system for those three-member wards would actually be, you know, not that difficult.
Oh, sending shivers down my spine, Daniel. thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate your time, mate, especially after what must have been a very intense campaign period, even with the digital side of things being the major way that people were doing it. And thank you, dear listener, for tuning in to the Right Dishonourable podcast. Check out the Patreon if you want to support more of this hard-cutting political journalism. Jimmy reminded me that journalist isn't a protected industry, and so we can call ourselves journalists.
I feel good about that decision. So
awesome. Toodaloo.
Bye-bye.